I taught in Saudi Arabia for 5 years at the University of Petroleum and Minerals in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia. It's located, Dhahran, I used to have to explain where Dhahran is, but it's become unnecessary given the events of the past year, but I will anyway. It's halfway up the what they call the Arabian Gulf, what we know as the Persian Gulf, on the Saudi side, on the western side. And it's right in the prime oil producing area. The reason that the city is there at all is because oil was found there back, I think, in the 30s. And the university that I taught at was originally a, as the name suggests, University of Petroleum Minerals, was a university to support Aramco, the Arabian American oil company. And later it became independent and under the auspices of the Ministry of Education. It's one of six universities in the country. And the interesting thing about the university was that all instruction took place in English. So that made my job fairly important as one of 70 English teachers there, and I worked in a an orientation year program to help all the students bring up their English level so that they could study college subjects. And I'm doing the same sort of thing now at PLU, but I spent 5 years in Saudi doing that. We were there from 83 to 88, not knowing what we were leaving when we left, in terms of what ensued this past year. As we all saw all the videos and so on from Dhahran, and that's where the one Scud missile did hit the barracks of the American there, so it became a very hot area. But I think the events of the past year have shown to us how very important it is to understand that part of the world. And it's not only that part of the world, I think that part of the world is very sensitive, but all the world, I think, is becoming more and more linked as our technology is allowing it, and linked in a number of ways. I heard someone from the Carnegie Foundation speak not too long ago saying that we're linked in travel, we're linked in communication, we're linked ecologically as we never have been before with factors such as global warming and the greenhouse effect, and linked economically. I know that this area of the country anyway is very linked to the Pacific Rim and the economies of Japan and so on. And I think that's a trend that's going to continue. It used to be that we could sit in the Western world and fairly well ignore what happened over there. But I don't believe we're going to have that luxury, if that is indeed a luxury, any longer. And so learning about the Middle East is fairly critical. It's a critical region for us in terms of course, economically, in terms of energy, and also in terms of history, where we come from, and religion. And learning about the people of the Middle East means, first of all, learning about Islam. Islam is the primary religion. I think 90-95% of the people are Islamic. Even though there are many different, or a number of different cultural groups, they do share that one religion. And Saudi Arabia itself is the center of Islam. It's the country in which Mecca, the holiest city, and Medina, the second holiest city, are located. And so I'm going to basically start from the beginning about Islam and talk about where it started, and hopefully we'll engender some questions and we can talk about it a little bit at what life was like for me over there too. However, my perspective is not one of a professional theologian or historian. I have read about it and I have talked about it and lived there, and I think it's more one of a man in the street, of having traveled not only in Saudi Arabia and 74, I was in Israel, Palestine, and spent some time in Cyprus and Bahrain and Qatar and Jordan, and have had connections with people in other Arab countries. So it's more of one who just has been connected and is interested in the area. So I think that covers the basics. I just, while I'm thinking of it, I might as well plug the couple of books that they asked me to do. There's about four copies of this one. This is fairly expensive, and this is a very broad, although it's concise because it's taking in the whole history of the Middle East. This is in the bookstore by Goldschmidt. And it covers not only Saudi Arabia, but all the Middle Eastern countries. This is a smaller one, $5, I think, Understanding Islam, and a very nice and very readable book. That's all, and there's a lot more copies of this in the bookstore. I have some videos here I was going to show, but the scheduling and so on is pretty tight. What I think I'll do with these is to leave them in the library in some way, so that if people want to check them out, they can, and view them. And there's three in a series here, starting with the five pillars of Islam, which I'm going to mention today, and going through the Middle Age period and up to Islam today, and then another one on the transition from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. So those are about 30-minute videos each, and if anyone's interested there, they'll be there. By way of other things, if you're interested, I also have something I copied off from Newsweek magazine. I'll leave some copies of this in the library, and it's on resources about the Middle East. Some nice two-page article. You can jot down some ideas if you're interested. Okay. Islam came to the world after it's the third of the three great religions that we think of, three great monotheistic religions, following upon Christianity and Judaism. And it started with Muhammad and he was born, as I jotted down here, in the year 570. It's generally called the year of the elephant. And it's because there were invaders that had come into Arabia from Ethiopia, actually Abyssinia at the time, and they were turned back by the local people, and it was deemed to be a propitious year for the Arabian people, and it was also the year, as legend says, that Muhammad was born. We don't know the exact date he was born, but we think it was then. He was born into the city of Mecca. Mecca is now a fairly famous city because it's the center of the Islamic religion, but at that time it was somewhat out of the way trading post and religious center. It's located, just put a map up here, I'll try to indicate some things here. It's located near the coast on the western side. It's near a much larger city of Jeddah, right there. And the other city I'm going to refer to is called Medina, which is up in the mountains, about 270 miles inland and northward from Mecca. These two cities, Mecca and Medina, are key in the life of Muhammad. By way of reference, we lived over here in Dahrana, completely on the opposite side. And also, whether I wanted to or not, I couldn't have visited these cities. They're considered holy cities and closed off to all non-Islamic people. There's an area of the haram, the forbidden area around the city, and if you're driving in your car, they stop you and ask you if you are Muslim. And pretty much exclude it, and they try to exclude everybody who is not. So the world of Muhammad at the time of his birth was one of rapid change. There had been a number of empires in existence in the world. The Western Roman Empire had collapsed about 100 years previous to that. The Byzantine Empire was centered in Istanbul, way up to the north and up to Turkey. In this area, way over in here, very far away from Saudi Arabia, given the transportation systems at the time. The Persian Empire, which now Iran, was basically in a state of collapse. And this area was, it's never been one, up until recent times, of prime world interest because it doesn't have a lot of resources, or at least didn't have resources that could be used up until recent times. And it was mainly being controlled by local tribes and there developed a sort of gap of power. But I'm getting a little ahead of it because I just want to talk a little bit about Mecca. It was a religious center, not of a monotheistic religion, but of a number of different gods being worshipped there. Their prime shrine, which is called the Kaaba, which is today the very, very center. They have a very exacting sense of their religion, that the Kaaba is a box, a tall cubicle building, is the word that cube comes from, in the center of the main mosque, in the center of Mecca. And that building contained a number of idols and so on. And the tribe that was in charge of Mecca, the Quraishi tribe, was Muhammad's tribe. And they benefited from Mecca being the center of all this religious trade and people coming on pilgrimages into the city of Mecca. Muhammad himself was an orphan. His father died before he was born. His mother died when Muhammad was age 6. He was taken under his grandfather's wings, who basically sent him out into the wilderness to be raised by the local Bedouin tribes, by his uncles out in the wilderness. The Bedouin are the nomadic peoples who travel around and kind of make their living as they can in the desert, a very harsh environment, and having to eke a living out of that kind of background. And a lot of, and even to this day, a lot of Arabians like to draw their roots back to those Bedouin people. They consider it manly and true sense of establishing their roots to go back, and to put it in our terms, to go back into the desert. But the fact that he was an orphan is something that became important in Islam as he learned to, as part of the religion was, he asked for the protection of the orphans and the widows. He also, and this is a very important point, was illiterate. And this is important because the claim of revelation that came to Muhammad, that he claimed that he did not read the words in advance, but they were given to him directly from the angel. He was a young man who came back into Mecca, had begun in a kind of a trading career, and he met a wealthy widow, and she was 40, he was 25, 26, and he married her and apparently earned an honorable living in traveling. We know that he had traveled to Damascus, which at that time was a Christian city. So we know that he had contact with Christian and Jewish scriptures. And he had a very successful marriage, apparently. But he wasn't satisfied with his life. He felt a kind of emptiness. And he started meditating. And he went up to the caves around Mecca. And in these hot and craggy caves, he felt the first revelation come to him, and he felt the angel telling him to recite, and he didn't believe himself at this point. He went back, and his wife encouraged him and believed in him, and in fact, I think it's said that she had a Christian cousin who thought that he was getting a revelation from God. And so Muhammad continued to experience these revelations, and these become the basis of the holy book, the Quran. I didn't bring my copy tonight, but I will later in the week. He seems to have been a very true mystic, and he believed in a very simple message, which was revolutionary in that area of the world at that time, and that was that there was, very simply, there was one God, and that that one God cared about the world, and that it was essentially a Jewish, Judeo-Christian kind of sort of concept of sin and repentance, although it's not quite the same, but that they should give up idol worship and licentious ways or be condemned to hellfire. And so right from the beginning, there was this sense of social reform, which was quite radical for his time. He promoted certain things like trade honestly, treatment of what would have been at that time a fair and honorable treatment of women. And he saw himself as a reformer, and not only a reformer, but a restorer, which seems odd to us from our perspective, but a restorer of monotheistic religion. And I think we have to understand, as Goldschmidt points out, is that there were a number of different interpretations of Christianity at the time. There were a lot of arguments about the nature of Jesus. Was he God? Was he man? Was he both? Was he merely a vision? And Muhammad tried to promote the idea that there was one God, that and I'll be talking more about their concept of Jesus later in the week, that Jesus was not God, but he was a prophet of God, and that Muhammad was the last in the line of the great prophets, that he had received these revelations, and that he was now establishing and restoring Islam. Islam itself means to obey, to serve, and a Muslim is one who serves, one who obeys. But at first, he had few followers, few people who believed in him and followed what he thought. His concept of religion at that time stood in opposition to the economic survival of Mecca and the trafficking in idols. And he had a very low period. He was supported by his wife, so he didn't need to work, per se, but he continued in his work as a prophet, and his wife died in 619. And a group of his followers were persecuted and sent off to Ethiopia across the Red Sea. And in 620, or in the years leading up to 620, some delegations came from the city of Medina down to Mecca to perform what was called the pilgrimage, and still is called the pilgrimage there. And they heard about Muhammad, they heard about him as a fair man, as a judicious person, and they asked him to come to Medina to be their lawgiver, to be their judge, to bring some warring tribes together. And there was also a very large Jewish community there that that they had trouble with. So this was a perfect opportunity for him. And slowly, because he was a very controversial person and that the Meccans wanted to control him, his followers left Mecca over a number of nights, and he himself with a friend left on one particular night, and that journey is what is a very significant journey in Islamic history, and it's the beginning of their calendar. The Muslims celebrate or follow a different calendar than what we do. This is currently, my wife is sitting here, it's the year 14 something, yeah, 1407, something like that, in their calendar. And in Saudi Arabia, our checks and other documents were dated according to their calendar. They also, and that calendar is based upon a lunar year, so it's 12 equal months throughout the year, whereas we follow a solar year. So their calendar is actually 13 days shorter, their year is 13 days shorter than our year. It's one of the different things. I just saw in the dining hall that the beginning of the Islamic year is in a few days. When we got to Saudi Arabia in 83, the beginning of the Islamic year was in October, I think, or late September. So their year continually changes in that sense. Anyway, so the year started from that time, and he went to Medina, and in Medina he did establish a community, the community became very strong, and eventually what happened was they went out and they had, let me see, I just want to make sure I cover everything here. He had some association with the local Jewish people, and they did not accept him as the prophet. They refused to accept his revelations, but they entered into working agreements. But at the same time, also, there are some traditions that changed. At that time, it was felt that one should pray toward Jerusalem. He changed that to the direction of prayer was towards Mecca. They changed the Sabbath from Saturday to Friday, and they incorporated some of the traditions of Mecca into the religion. So what seems to be a following in the tradition of Judaism and Christianity also has its own Arabian sense to it. Okay. So he consolidated power in Medina, basically, is the point of his stay there. And he went back then to Mecca, and he knew that he would be opposed by the people in Mecca who still were protecting their interests. And he made a treaty with them that he would come back in a year to go to the Kaaba to have his Hajj, which he did. And a year after that, then he broke the treaty, assembled 10,000 men, and took the city without force. The Meccans gave in to the inevitable. Eventually, most of those Meccans, even though they had opposed him throughout his lifetime, were brought into the faith. They accepted the faith of Islam. And the city was cleaned up in the sense of the idols being thrown out of the Kaaba, and the religion was established. So that really was the beginning of Islam, and this section then takes us through Muhammad's life. And he died in 632, the age of 63, not a rich man, but an accomplished one, a man who had taken the monotheistic religion, brought it to Arabia, given it its own sense of identity with the traditions and customs of Arabia, and brought that into that the Arabic language, and the language of the Quran is Arabic, and it's considered to be the holy language, and Muslims are loath to translate their Quran into any other language, saying that it loses the holiness and loses its whole sense of the originality, because they believe that the Quran, as we have it on earth, is an exact replica of a heavenly prototype in Arabic. So that takes us to the beginning of Islam. And at the end of his life, Muhammad had then the problem of how to have this religion continue on after him. It was, he did not consider himself divine. That's not part of the revelation at all. He did not want to be the center of the religion. And they consider that, in fact, heretical, and that's their main gripe with Christians, is the fact that we have a man who we consider also to be divine in Jesus. And so before he died, he had married many wives, actually. He had 10 before he died. But his favorite one, her father, Abu Bakr, became the caliph, and that is the leader of the people, not a religious leader, but a leader politically and socially of the group. Okay. The questions up to this point, I know I cover a lot. It's hard to talk about the initial part of a religion in such a short period of time, but I'll stop for any questions or clarifications. Yeah.
They believe, you said that the Quran was written in their language and that it was also the language of heaven?
Yes, that's right. They believe it's essentially God's language. And they have frozen one type of Arabic, the Quranic Arabic, at that time. And the Muslims are actually fairly of two minds about their language. They believe on one hand that it's God's language and it should be maintained as it is, and therefore they hate the way that they themselves speak Arabic because they consider it a lesser form. But of course language changes. We don't speak in 6th century, and well, English didn't exist in the 6th century, but we don't, no language would stay the same for that many years. Some of their speeches and some of their documents are still written in the classical Arabic, the Quranic Arabic, but for the most part, there are various dialects from Egypt to Saudi Arabia that people speak.
Is the entire Quran as it is today the result of the revelation to him, or?
That's what they believe. The Quran was written down. It wasn't written in his lifetime, and so it relied upon the recollections of the people. But a lot of biblical history is that way, and in fact, the people of the Middle East have an oral tradition, which is one of the problems I continually encounter in teaching my students English, is that they learn English very well on a spoken level, but they don't do so well on the written level. So what they did, they would have recited the Quranic verses in Muhammad's lifetime and after his lifetime, and they compiled it very soon given our standards of biblical literature after he died, you know, within 100 years, I think they had compiled it into the Quran. So it's a set group of writings. It's very large. It consists of 114 chapters or surahs that are organized by the length. The traditional organization is by the length. So the first one is just a few verses, and the next one is longer, and the next one's longer of the chapters. So they're not organized chronologically, which makes it difficult for us to read.
Mm-hmm. You'd alluded to the Kaaba as the center of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to talk about that more? Could you explain that a little bit more?
Well, the Kaaba is the center of Islam, and it's one of the five pillars of Islam, is that one, as a Muslim, should go to Mecca during one's lifetime and perform a pilgrimage to go there as the center of the religion. And so they believe in a very physical, very real center of the religion, which is a hallmark of Islam, is that there are exacting requirements of Muslims, or at least of traditional Muslims, which can be very comforting in a way. You know, in Christianity, I think we have so many traditions, and some of them are. There was just this video on women and images of women going back, and one of the women in the video said that in Protestant tradition, if I can quote it right, she said everything is theoretical. And for Muslims, everything is practical, as much, not everything, I mean, they still have a concept of an almighty God, but there are many things which are practical, right down to the direction that one prays and the number of times that you pray in a day and things like that.
You mentioned the Hajj.
Mm-hmm.
Would you explain that?
Mm-hmm. The Hajj is the pilgrimage that happens every year in Saudi Arabia, and that a Muslim is supposed to go on once in their lifetime. And that's right to Mecca, physically to go there. and it's supposed to be a tremendous opportunity. Friends of ours who are Muslim, Carol worked with some, one woman in particular, explained it as a very moving experience to go there, as we might imagine, with people who believe the same thing that you do, and to have the sense of community and purpose in there. And they go there and they perform a number of rituals. Some of those rituals are carried over from the pre-Islamic days. For example, there's a stone there called the Black Stone, which they believe the God sent direct, that this stone was used by them in the building of the Kaaba. And so, again, very literal sense of place and destiny. And so they do a circular kind of rotation around the Kaaba and kiss the stone if they can get close enough. And there are a number of different rituals that they perform. Uh-huh.
Well, after they've done the Hajj, a man, can he wear a certain turban?
He's known as a Haji. And some people even change their name after going to Mecca, so they're known as Haji Abdullah or whatever. And it's an honorific title that they're always referred to in that way. Not all people who do it, because it's more common now that people will perform the Hajj. But I don't know. I don't know about a turban or anything like that. I didn't see. But there are specific clothes that one is to wear when going there. It's a seamless garment. It's a terrycot, a very simple garment that they wear. And we flew out of Saudi Arabia one time, and there were groups of men with these garments on. And it's the only time that I believe I ever saw their legs or other things, because it's a very loose thing, and it was all around. And but again, that's prescribed in the Quran, and it's very specific and literal. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to go back to you mentioning about the translation.
Uh-huh.
Does that vary then from country to country? For example, in Iran, and then how does that meaning get muddled or lost? And then is there contention with that translation and with the concepts?
That's not something I know a lot about, because I spent my time in Islamic countries that spoke in Arabic, except for very short stays in Turkey. So, of course, they share the Arabic language. I think that when religious services are performed or the prayers are said, that they are said in Arabic. And it would be much like it was for Catholics up until Vatican II, is that Latin was the holy language, and so all the rites and rituals were said in that way. I think, though, that the Quran is translated into other countries. By the way, Saudi Arabia is a minor country in terms of population of Muslims. That the Islamic world spreads from North Africa all the way across the Middle East into Southeast Asia, up into China. The largest Islamic country is Indonesia, with hundreds of millions of Muslims. There is a large and growing group of Muslims in China, Western China, and in the Soviet Union. And it's one of the problems that the Soviets are having right now, is trying to control those Islamic regions. Mm-hmm.
You said that Muhammad accepted Christ as a prophet, but not as the Son of God. Does that mean that what part of the biblical... the Bible has been discovered? Did they accept?
They believe very strongly that Muhammad did not read the Bible and then reform it for his own purposes. They believe that he received it as original revelation from God, and that what we actually have as a Bible is a corruption, and especially in the verses and the books of Paul, in which they spell out the divinity of Christ. And as I said, I'm going to go into that in a lot more detail later in the week, but they talk and give a lot of honor. There's no cutting down of Jesus in any way, speaking badly of him in the Quran. It's honoring him, but saying that he was one of many prophets, a very highly esteemed prophet, but not the Son of God.
They acknowledge his virgin birth.
Yes, they acknowledge his virgin birth, and he's often referred to as the Son of Mary.
How does the woman stand on the Hajj?
Interestingly enough, it's the one place in Islam where the woman does not have to be veiled. When they go to Mecca, the woman is supposed to take off her veil and be equal.
How far down the line did you get the Sunni Shiite split?
Okay, we're coming to that. And that has to do after Muhammad and replacing him as leader of the group. There was one other question, then I'll go on.
I wrote a paper on this many years ago, but there's a recent book out that all the women are reading, and we tried to bring the author to Minneapolis. It's called The Saudis, and I'm trying to unroll the reel.
I have it here. Sandra McKay.
She's a wife of a doctor. Can you tell them about this book?
Yeah.
Readable for the
public group. Right. Sandra McKay is a woman who was a doctor in Saudi Arabia. Whose husband was a doctor in Saudi Arabia, and she did a number of jobs while she was there. And the one thing that she did undercover is she was an undercover correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And she published a number of articles under a pseudonym while she was still there. And she had to be very careful about getting information out of the country so that it wasn't found out who she was, because a lot of the stuff that she wrote was not complimentary. Basically, all press has to be pretty complimentary of the ruling family. I want to talk more about Islam per se than Saudi Arabia right now, but of course Saudi Arabia is of interest to us because of the recent events in the past year, but they have a very, very autocratic government there. There's no other way of putting it. They have total control of the people, total control of the press, and they don't want any information uncensored going out of the country. And so when she finally did leave the country, then she published the book under her own name. And it's a very interesting book, a little bit chatty at times, kind of like, hey guys, this is the way it is. But I think she has some good insights into the role of women, especially in the culture.
I wonder how many read the article of those women that took the car and drove through the city?
That's right. In the past year, something that was well publicized about the Gulf War was that a number of Saudi women drove cars through Riyadh, the capital, and have been, I don't know if persecuted is the right word, but certainly suppressed since then. Well, let me go on a little bit about Islam, and because I want to get a sense of the country. How are we doing on time? We're okay. So the Quran, then, is their holy book. It's the one holy book. They also have another set of traditions that are called the Hadith that were written down, which were sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, and things that people recall that he had said but weren't revelations per se. But these sayings are very important because they form one of the base documents of Islamic law. They follow a whole different legal system, as you might imagine, than what we do. And it's based on Quranic revelations, based on the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad and the main followers of Muhammad after he died. So those are the two main collections, as any religion has its base documents. Those are the base documents of Islam. The Quran is a very poetical book, matching the poetry and oral traditions of the Middle East. I'll just read a short passage. It goes like this. By the fig and by the olive, by Mount Sinai and this inviolate land, we molded man into a most noble image, and we shall reduce him to the lowest of the low. Except the believers who do good works, for there shall be boundless recompense. What then can alter this make what then can after this make you deny the last judgment? Is Allah not the best of judges? And it's that sort of poetical allusions and non-historical writing, as we sense history, that the Quran is written in. And I find it very beautiful in reading it, but also somewhat non-linear, in the sense of this happened and this happened and this happened, and you have to kind of dig the history out of the poetry, and it's a whole different type of writing. The earlier surahs that were written were from Mecca, the later ones were from Medina, and are more direct rules and regulations, and very direct. Believers are to kill no game whilst on pilgrimage, for example. These kind of things. And I think I said earlier that the Arabian religion, or the Islamic religion, is a representation of the Arabian mind. And it's hard to imagine what I mean by that, but there's a quote from T.E. Lawrence, more popularly known as Lawrence of Arabia, who I think catches it very nicely. The Arabian mind reflects the desert into which the people are born. And it said, and he said, in talking about meeting them, he said, in the very outset, at the first meeting with them, was found a universal clearness or hardness of belief, almost mathematical in its limitation and repellent in its unsympathetic form. Semites had no halftones on their register of vision. They were a people of primary colors, or rather of black and white, who saw the world always in contour. They were a dogmatic people, despising doubt, our modern crown of thorns. They knew only truth and untruth, belief and unbelief, without our hesitating retinue of finer shades. And I think that, to me, explains a lot of the mindset that we encountered, is that things either were or weren't. You either believed or you didn't, or there were ways of living a holy life, or there weren't. And that's represented in, at least in Saudi Arabia, in the religion. I think there are other parts, other interpretations of Islam in the Muslim world, which, is, as I noted, was very broad, which may be more forgiving. They have their basic belief, as I said, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is a prophet. And if one says that and believes it, one is a Muslim. That's all that you need to do to be a Muslim, to profess that. That's the profession of faith. In that sense, it's a very simple and direct religion. One of the things that is appealing about it, I think, and the reason that it has appealed to so many people in the world, and especially to poor people, is that there are no intermediaries. There's no priestly class that one has to work through. There's only man and God, and you're there directly, and you don't have to go through a lot of hoops in order to get one's religion. Yes, they believe. And I'm not going to try to apologize for the Islamic sense of women and God, or their where they placed women, but in the historical context of where Islam came, it was an elevation of women, not only in their status within the community, but also their legal status. And for example, women up to that time, when their husbands died, their property would have been confiscated. Muhammad, in honoring widows, wanted to make sure that their property was kept to be their own. Now, as we see the world and as it's changed, we see the Islamic women as highly repressed, highly subjugated. But that's because we're dealing from totally different cultural perspective. The Islamic women that we knew...
I'm asking you, seriously. About you said something about the relationship between
I think that would be man.
Does that mean generic man, or does that mean
I meant generic man. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I should use more.
Also elaborate on that.
Yeah. Okay. I don't think that there is any sense that women get put off in their relationship to God, although they definitely have different roles in the community, in an Islamic community, and those are very traditional roles, as we know them. But in terms of theologically, they have to perform the same rites, the five pillars of Islam, and they have the same standing as men. So in that sense, Does that answer your question, Nancy, or is that...
Well, I think it's a pretty important question.
Yeah. Yeah, it is an important question, and I don't know if I can fully answer
it. What we talked about earlier was, in terms of those public expressions of faith, or however you would describe those, the five times mm-hmm. that one would pray, that in her experience, women were seen as, men were seen as doing that very publicly.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't see women doing that praying in
no, that's,
way.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the same as in Judaism, I think, in a more traditional form, is that the men go to the mosque on Friday, and the women would perform their rites at home. That the Hajj is the one exception to that, I think, is where they all come together. They basically believe, at least in Saudi Arabia, and this may be different again in other Islamic countries, but they basically believe that men and women should be separated at all times.
But they still manage to have children.
But they still manage to have children.
Okay.
Yeah. You don't okay. mean that last sentence.
Hmm?
That's really what you meant, that they should be separated.
Well, of course not in as a husband and wife, but almost essentially, yes. I mean, the man's world is a man's world, and he deals with men almost all the time. They socialize. One of my students was going to Bahrain for a vacation, and I said, oh, are you going to take your wife and have, you know, a fun time? And he said, my wife? He must be joking. And he was going over with his buddies and going to enjoy a weekend in Bahrain. And so that would have been pretty normal. And it would be seen as abnormal to be otherwise within that culture. Another example is friends of ours who got into the Islamic culture a lot more than we had opportunity to, mainly because their Arabic was a lot better. They went camping with Saudis once, and once they went camping, the men and the women were separated, and literally were until the nighttime, in which they would come together to sleep together. And our friends, an American woman and an American man, they got together. They were frustrated because they had no time in which to communicate with each other during the day, you know, about the children or about what, you know, in the way that they normally would. And so they arranged to go on a walk each day in the middle of the day together. And when Betsy got back to the women's quarters, they all wanted to know what was going on. What did he want? What did he talk about? You know, what would he possibly have to talk about? Did he want sex?
In the middle of the day.
So, you know, that is their concept, that men and women are separated almost all the time. It's a very different concept of community. And even if I were in my father's house, and usually what happens after one gets married is you bring your bride to live in your father's house. And if my wife were there and my brother came in, my wife would have to be veiled because they're not supposed to be shown to other men, even within the same family. So it's very strict in that way, as it's strictly practiced. One of the things I really want to encourage, though, I know it's hard, but is a sense of this is a different culture, and it's one thing that we had to learn, is that you have to accept it on its own terms. And it goes against our value systems, and maybe you're saying it's okay for me because I'm a man, but I found it oppressive too, that I couldn't talk with the part of the population that I find it easiest to talk with. You know, I never got to meet a Saudi woman in 5 years of being there. And I didn't like that at all. And I realize that it's very oppressive for Saudi women. But they've got to have their culture and move with it and grow with it on their own terms. And I think if we came in and imposed something that we said was, you know, this is our way, our Western roles, on them, that would be artificial, and it would be rejected, and it would be more destabilizing. They've got to come with it and accept it in their own way if they're going to make any difference. And the women there, I think, are seeing different roles. There are dramatic changes since the coming of oil and westernization in the country. For example, women are educated now in a way that they never had a chance to before. And that has been a very radical thing, and one thing that the House of Saud, the Saudi royal family, has been highly criticized for initially, was for educating women, and they were insistent upon that.
Did you get a chance to ask your question?
There was another question.
There was a question over here.
Okay.
Oh, what about the mother in the home? Does she keep a veil on around her children?
No, not around her children.
Brothers?
No. No. As far as I'm aware of, do you know? I don't think so. No.
Did you ever see any of their justice?
No. No.
You didn't?
No, I didn't want to. I think what you're referring to is the hand chopping or things like that.
Pictures of it. Some of the troops used to get pictures back in the old days.
Yeah. Islamic justice is quite different from our system. I guess, we are all familiar with the concept of chopping a hand off or capital punishment. And I wouldn't defend that in any sense, but their response to that is, and again I want to give you their response, is that there is much, much less crime in Saudi Arabia than in America. And although there is little forgiveness if someone is caught and convicted, and I'm sure a lot of innocent people probably are convicted that shouldn't be, and we never hear about it. But that's the price we pay for more openness and trying towards more justice in our sense. But their response is, you can walk down the streets, you can have your car filled with cash. I, went to the money changers when we got our check to change it into dollars, and would frequently see tellers counting out tens of thousands of dollars right there with no problem, or people walking out with a big wad of money in their pocket. So there is much, much less crime, but they pay a price for it. But there is a lot less of that sort of punishment than what we're led to believe, too. I mean, statistically wise. And again, statistics are very hard to come by because they just don't publish them. But occasionally they would say on the television there is going to be an execution in such and such a place. And their belief is much like it was in our country 100 years ago, that executions should be public to be a detriment to the rest of the population for committing the crime. Okay.
But if there's less crime, then obviously there will be less punishment.
Right. Right. And again, I'm not apologizing for it, I'm just presenting their point of view. They have a different culture and they do things in their own way. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that women are having a chance to have some more further education. Is that a Western influence? How did that come about?
I think so. I think it's Western. I think it's pressure within the royal family itself. In Saudi, is that their women wanted an education and that there were leading women. The women are very influential in a very hidden way, and in a way that I wasn't aware of course. Some people have even suggested that Saudi Arabia is a matriarchy, where the women actually control things from inside in terms of relationships. I know they control, for example, most weddings. It's not the father who makes the arrangements for who one marries, it's the mother, and the mother meets with other mothers, and they arrange who's going to marry who, or who will meet whom, anyway. So there is a hidden women's power. As far as the education, I think there were women within the royal family who pushed for it in Faisal's reign. He was the third monarch king. And now women can be educated up through the university level. I think probably almost all women get an elementary education. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. they don't have the homeless and whatnot that we do on account of their tax burden.
Not on the scale that we do. They have a lot. I mean, it's very much a social. If you're talking about a sense of community and of taking care of one another, I think on a whole, Muslim countries are much better at it than Christian countries, so-called Christian countries. They don't have... I had one person begging in the streets in the time I was there, and that was a woman who I think who had been dishonored and for whatever reason, and one never knows. But of course they have a much smaller population and a much greater supply of cash, and so they can provide a lot of social welfare. For an example, a young man can get $100,000 loan interest-free to build a house just by being a young man of marriageable age and establishing that home and so on. All the education is free. My students were paid almost as much as I was to teach them. The graduate students were paid more. They were appalled by the thought that one would have to work in the summers in order to make their way through college. I told them I worked in factories, and they said, "You, teacher?" So,
did you have women in your class?
No, not at all. No. The only time that I would never have taught women at my institution because there were no women enrolled there. There were Saudi universities for women, and the man who taught there would do so via videotape. Or via a video image, yeah.
Have you ever had a chance to read the Satanic Verses?
No, I haven't, no.
I
read bits of
it.
Good question. I can't. Has anybody? That's one book I just haven't got to.
I think there are a lot of similarities between Islam and Christianity when you get beyond the traditions and the rituals about the basic tenets of salvation.
That's something I want to really get into later in the week. I think there are similarities and there are definite differences. I mentioned the differences in their belief about Christ. They do. They have a very strong sense of a God who cares, monotheistic religion, a oneness of God, who will eventually judge the creation, judge his people, and Muhammad wanted to see his religion to be seen in that light, very much in the tradition of the three religions. He considered it the kind of the culmination. One thumbnail sketch is they thought that the Judaism was all law, Christianity was all love, and that Islam is somewhere in the middle. That's a simplification, and like all simplifications, it's inadequate, but it maybe will help. We're almost done with time, just a couple more.
The Moros in the Philippines used to go Hermantada.
Pardon?
And that's why we have a 45. We go up to the priest and get all bound up and go out and start killing Christians. Is that part of their religion?
Killing Christians? I think probably most killing is done for political reasons rather than religious ones, at least in the present time. There is a misnomer about Muslims that when they established their religion, they did so by the sword. And that is probably less true of Muslims than it was of Christians. They basically established a political structure, and they allowed people to be non-Christians, very much in the Roman, non-Muslims, very much like the Romans and the Persians had done in earlier time. They followed that tradition with their empire. There is, of course, we've heard a lot in recent times, especially from Iran, of the holy war and the jihad, and that I would more isolate to the Shiites as being more fanatical group, and again, it's some of the Shiites, but not all. Particularly, those around.
Well, Muslims do not try to force anybody else to be a Muslim, like a Christian or a Jew. They have to accept it on their own, right?
They have to accept it on their own. Yes, I mean they're certainly persecuted if they are born into a Muslim family and leave the faith. That's just totally unacceptable. And it can be a capital offense in Saudi Arabia. So if one is going to be a Christian there, it's a big punishment to pay. But I don't know of any circumstance now in which they're forcing people to become Muslims. No. Why don't I end the session here at 7:45. And if you want to stay for a few more questions before Vespers, we can, and others can feel free to go.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Thank you.